your questions on immigration, annexation, and tariffs. Date modified colon 2025-04-29T2039:57.158Z. Description colon here is a selection of those answered by our staff writers and correspondents. Comma dot, your questions on tariffs, annexation, and immigration after Trump's first 100 days, 1 hour ago, save, watch. Trump's first 100 days in just 2 minutes. BBC's North America team asked for your questions to mark U.S. President Donald Trump's first 100 days in office. Here is a selection of those answered by our staff writers and correspondents. They have aimed to explain the context and facts behind several of the biggest topics in the Trump administration, including the economy and how Trump would handle a war. A UK-based reader asks how the UK economy might be impacted by tariffs. The decisions made thousands of miles away will affect the UK economy. Most directly affected are those exporters selling into America, contending with that 10% extra charge, or even more in some cases, being applied to their goods. Do they try to compensate for that by cutting costs elsewhere or risk a blow to sales? And complex supply chains mean that disruption to other economies could be felt here. Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey last week referred to a growth shock. Many economists have cut their forecasts. No one yet is clear on how this trade war will play out. The uncertainty itself is damaging. But the impact on inflation could work the other way. Countries such as China may be tempted to divert goods here instead, given the barriers they face in America. And the drop in oil and other commodity prices, amid market turmoil, could also bode well for keeping bills down. So many economists reckon that with a weaker growth and inflation outlook, interest rates could fall faster than previously thought. A cut of 0.25 percentage points is widely expected next week, another could follow in June. Another reader asks how Trump's immigration policy is likely to affect Canadian-American relations, especially for dual citizens or people with mixed status families. If the first 100 days are anything to go by, relations between Canada and the U.S. are almost certainly going to continue to be tense, both as a result of tariffs and Trump's repeated, and near-constant calls for Canada to become part of the U.S. We had a taste of that just this week, when, as Canadians headed to the polls in their general election, Trump took to Truth Social to call on Canadians to elect him, seemingly referring to himself as a candidate to reap the benefits of being the cherished 51st state. America can no longer subsidize Canada with the hundreds of billions a year that we have been spending in the past, he said. It makes no sense unless Canada is a state. How that impacts dual citizens or mixed status families is a bit harder to answer. But we're seeing a newfound sense of nationalism among many Canadians in response to Trump's rhetoric and policies, and some Americans in Canada have even reportedly given up their citizenship. While cross-border ties are very unlikely to ground to a standstill, many Canadian citizens, even those with U.S. families, are likely to be more cautious when crossing the border, particularly after high-profile cases of Canadians being detained at the border. In one case, an actress named Jasmine Moody was detained by ICE for about 2 weeks. Later writing about her experience in a viral article in The Guardian, Reuters, people protest outside Milwaukee Federal Building and U.S. Courthouse, after Wisconsin County Judge Hannah Dugan was arrested by U.S. officials, charging her with helping a man in her court evade immigration authorities. A reader asks what Trump's first 100 days tell us about how he'd handle a major international crisis, like another pandemic or a war. It's hard to say how exactly Trump would handle a major international crisis, but we have had glimpses that may provide a few clues. Trump's first crisis came just over a week into his administration on January 29, when a U.S. Army helicopter collided with a passenger aircraft over the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., killing 67 people. Later that morning, I sat in the White House briefing room as Trump, with no evidence, alleged that the diversity, equity, and inclusion policies at the Federal Aviation Administration may have led to the crash. This suggests that in the event of a crisis, Trump is later to fire from the hip, sometimes speaking before all the facts are established. Many will remember Trump's initial dismissal of the COVID-19 pandemic in his first administration, sometimes downplaying it as something that would soon disappear. More so than other presidents, Trump also leans heavily on the power of the executive branch, making decisions from the Oval Office that have real-world implications, sometimes bypassing any discussion on Capitol Hill. Those close to Trump are quick to say that he listens intently to his advisors, often letting discussions play out amongst them before his eyes. This is, for example, largely what happened with the tariffs issue. Ultimately, however, he is the one who decides the government's course of action, even if he lets his inner circle, which is perhaps more loyal and disciplined than in the last administration, carry out the details. Arafin in Bangladesh wants to know how developing countries can navigate this evolving trade landscape and mitigate the risks. There is just no way poorer countries could ever eliminate their trade surplus with the United States. The world envisioned by Donald Trump, where citizens of developing countries buy as many American products as are sold the other way, is simply not possible. The average Bangladeshi citizen, for example, is 32 times poorer than the average American. In this case, the best Bangladeshi officials could do is promise Washington they will reduce some non-tariff barriers that are in place that make it hard for American companies to do business there. For example, they could scrap quotas on imports, cut red tape or tackle corruption more effectively. These small concessions, along with the assumption that American consumers won't put up with rocketing prices, may lead to a softening or removal of Trump's tariffs. After all, if countries with large and cheap workforces can't sell Americans affordable goods, then who will? One other thing that developing countries will want to consider closely is the role of China in all of this. If you're a worker in a clothing factory in Bangladesh, a 37% U.S. tax might seem a crippling blow to your livelihood, but it's still better than the 125% tariff that Chinese manufacturers are facing. As a Malaysian rubber glove manufacturer told me recently, we're not exactly jumping with joy, but this may well benefit us. Limiting dealings with China has been suggested as a way for developing countries to get a better trade deal with the White House. But that isn't very realistic. Beijing is by far and away the number one investor in the developing world. If you live in Africa, Asia, or South America, it's probably China building your railways, factories, and power plants, not the United States. The American consumer market is still the richest in the world, and developing countries will want to fight tooth and nail to maintain access to it, but equally there is no way they can side with the U.S. over China. Watch, White House slams Amazon over plan to display cost of tariffs. Chris in County Durham, UK, asks if Donald Trump is making millions of dollars on the U.S. stock market by initiating a slump in share values, buying heavy, then reversing his policies to watch his share prices rocket up. Critics are accusing President Trump of manipulating the stock market. White House officials have denied the allegations, with Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt calling it part of Trump's art of the deal. Here's what we know so far. On April 9th, Trump posted on Truth Social, in all caps, "This is a great time to buy. DJT." Shortly after, he announced he was pausing the toughest tariffs for 90 days. In between, options traders placed big bets on a market rebound, which ended up being spot on. This led to accusations of market manipulation and insider trading, with Democrats like Senator Adam Schiff calling for an investigation. However, these cases are hard to prove and even harder when you're talking about the president. Legal experts say it would be a high bar to prove Trump did something illegal in this case. Plus, he posted the information publicly. Claims of insider trading might have some merit under the Stock Act, which restricts public officials from profiting off non-public information. Although the White House could argue that the president can't gain information about policy changes if he created them. So, it's still up in the air, but probably not something he needs to lose sleep over. Jean-Claude asks if there any way within the U.S. Constitution by which Congress could stop Trump's tariffs and take away his freedom to issue executive orders at will. Donald Trump has been pushing the boundaries of presidential authority with both his tariff declarations and more than 130 executive orders. To do so, he has been asserting that Congress has given him the power to take these actions. To answer your question simply, then, any power that Congress gives, Congress can take back. Traditionally, executive orders are a presidential interpretation of how laws should be implemented. Congress could step in and tell the White House that those interpretations are wrong. Trump has been citing a 1977 law that grants him power to enact tariffs in cases of national emergency. Congress could amend that law or pass legislation that says no such emergency exists. There has already been a bipartisan proposal in the Senate to do exactly that. The challenge for Trump's opponents is finding a majority in the two chambers of Congress, both narrowly controlled by Republicans, to do so. The House of Representatives, in particular, is full of Republicans who are marching in lockstep with the president. The House recently adopted a provision that would make it much harder to rescind Trump's proposed tariffs on Canada and Mexico, for instance. Even if Congress was able to reach agreement on curtailing presidential power, Trump could decide to exercise his veto to block it from becoming law, something he's already threatened to do with the Senate tariff bill. And if he did that, it would take two-thirds of both chambers to override the president. So Congress does have the ability to stop Trump, but perhaps not the interest or will to do so, at least not unless and until next year's midterm elections shift the balance of power in the legislature toward the Democrats. Rachel in Canada wonders if we can comment on what the real threat of annexation is for Canada with Trump in office. Should we be worried? A lot depends on what the U.S. president means when he talks about making Canada the 51st state. It's unlikely that both the U.S. and Canada would agree to it through formal means, the bar is high. It would need to be approved by both chambers in the U.S. Congress, including at least 60 votes in support in the Senate, which has 100 seats. It would also likely require amending the Canadian Constitution, which would likely require unanimous provincial consent, no easy task, as well as Parliament's approval. It's also highly unlikely that the U.S. would invade Canada militarily. Trump has spoken about forcing the issue through economic pressure, with Canada sending roughly 75% of its goods south of the border. He does have some leverage. Canada has already been hit with tariffs from the U.S., including the blanket tariffs on goods, though there is currently an exception for products covered by the USMCA trade deal.